Once there was a man who had two sons. And their names were Cain and Abel. Or maybe their names were Jacob and Esau. Come to think of it, I think it might have been Moses and Aaron. There was a man who had two sons. Wait a minute, maybe it was Saul and David. Maybe it was Matthew and Peter. Maybe it was Peter and Paul. You follow my drift? There have always been brothers. Literal brothers like Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau, twins that fought even in the womb. And sometimes not so literal, but David and Saul, a king and his successor, complicated issues involved there. Peter and Paul, Peter and Matthew, always, it seems, we have this ongoing battle with those closest and dearest to us. Probably why the psalmist raises his voice in prayer one day and says, "Behold how good it is, how good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell together in unity." The subtext there is, how good and how rare it is when brothers and sisters get along. Once there was a man who had two sons. Thus begins probably the most, as I said with the kids, the most famous story in all of Scripture. It's a big story. I love that word, big story. I stopped in at the Hindu temple in Madrid. Have you guys ever, some of you have been up there. We took a road trip over there. Really interesting place. Lots of statuary and stories told in the art and the. They have like a place like this, you know, only there's more of them. And in each little alcove, there's a panorama, a story being told. And this guy very excitedly took me around. He said, "This is big story. This is big story." You know, and he told me all these big stories. You know, there's a big story about Shiva, and there's a big story about Ganesh, and there's a big story about, there's so many deities in Hinduism. Lots of big stories. I came back here, and I walked in here, and I looked at this, and I thought, hey, we have a big story too. Right? We have a big story. This is a big story. The story of the prodigal son is a big story. I'll give you a sophisticated name for it. Carl Jung used to deal in archetypes. This is a story of archetypes, and he would actually name a story like this. I love what he'll say it like this. These are stories that never happened but are always true. That's how Carl Jung described the big story, right? I don't know if this ever really happened, but it's always true. And that's what I'll say about the prodigal son, the story of the prodigal son. We love to just get in there and wrestle, right? Some of you are in Bible study. We just love to argue the details of it. Well, why was this brother this way, and why did that brother, and wouldn't the father have done this, and where did he go in a land far away, and why was he eating pods out of the pig? Oh, it's gross. You know, we get into all this. We miss the fact that this never happened, but it's always true. It's just always true. There's always two brothers. I don't care if you're an only child. There's always two brothers. I don't care if you're a sister. There's always two sisters, right? Remember Mary and Martha? About a month ago, we were looking at Mary and Martha. Another big story. I don't know if that ever happened, but it's always true, right? And when we talked about Mary and Martha, I suggested maybe these are two different parts of us. Maybe there's the worker bee, the busybody in the kitchen, and maybe there's the contemplative who wants to sit and pray and contemplate. So allow me to tell you this big story in a way that's archetypal, and to suggest, like I did with Mary and Martha, that we don't have to pick sides and say, you know, that big brother, he had it coming to him. Or, you know, the big brother was the good one, he was the responsible one, if we could only get this younger brother to whip it up and get into shape. Right? When you hear a story like this and your buttons are pushed, by the way, you should pay attention to that. That's about you. That's not really about the story. That's about you. If you have big brother issues with this guy, or you have little brother issues with this story, there's something to pay attention to there. We have three main characters in this big story that never happened but is always true. We have a younger brother, we have an older brother, and we have a father. So it's unfortunate, but as often happens in the Bible, they're all male characters. All the starring characters are male. We'll deal with patriarchy in our own way, but given the crowd that Jesus is working with, patriarchy works, right? And to tell a story that uproots patriarchy in a way is a very subversive thing, and this thing does it. This father does not act like the distant, you know, emotionally unavailable father, does he? That might reinforce the patriarchy of the day and even of our day, but this father goes above and beyond. It's why I've called him the prodigious father, not to be mistaken with the prodigal son, right? It's a word that comes from the same family of words, prodigious. It's funner to say. I like the word prodigious. I don't know where we got the word prodigal. It probably is in the King James Version of the Bible. It means, like prodigious does, it's like opulent, overwhelming, not overwhelming. My words are just all leaving me. Let me tell you what prodigious means, because I looked it up with a thesaurus. But the prodigal son, he was over the top with his spending and his loose living. Our Bible today calls it dissolute living, right? Is that what you read? Dissolute living. The King James probably called it prodigal. It's wasteful. It's extravagant. It's over the top. Prodigious, the word I'm going to give to the father, is extraordinary, phenomenal, remarkable, exceptional, unusual, in a good way maybe. Wonderful, amazing, grace, how sweet the sound. Impressive, huge, don't forget huge, it's going to be huge. Impressive, vast, another fun word to say, copious. The copious father. Here's the parable of the copious father. Does that describe the father in this story to you? Impressive, extravagant, phenomenal, remarkable, extraordinary. I'll tell you some things that make him extraordinary. He's lost a son. Basically, before this story is over, he's going to lose both sons, right? One of them, through real distance, he leaves, goes to a far-off time. He basically comes to him and says, "Drop dead, Dad." That's the translation of, "Can I have my inheritance early?" Right? Isn't that what that's saying, basically? "Drop dead, Dad. I've got stuff I want to do." And he goes off and he does it and he wastes it and he's bankrupt and he's feeding the pigs before too long. This younger son comes to himself. It actually says that. When he came to himself, we call it hitting rock bottom. For a young Jewish boy to be feeding the pigs, I think we call that rock bottom. When the food that the pigs is eating looks good and appetizing, we call that rock bottom. When he's fantasizing about, boy, if somebody would just give me some of these pods, I would be satisfied, we call that rock bottom. And when you hit rock bottom, often what happens is you come to yourself. You have an aha moment. You have an awakening, we'll call it. And he begins to talk to himself. A lot of us do that when we have this, you know, Paul, you know what you should do? I should go back, and I should say to my dad, and then he has this little speech, and he rehearses it. "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you." I like those prepositions. "Against heaven and before you. I am not fit to be called your son, but would you treat me as a hired hand?" Because he's thinking, you know, even my hired hands back home had better, they had bread and food on their table. They didn't have to fantasize about eating pods that the pigs are eating. So he rehearses, and I just picture him walking all the way home, from a distant land, rehearsing this speech he's going to give his dad. "Father, I have sinned against you and against heaven. I am not fit to be called your son, but would you take me back as a hired hand?" Over and over, and he gets home. And the prodigious father, this is why I call him prodigious, he sees him while he is still far off. The Bible says he was still far off. I don't know how far away he was, but that tells me a couple things. One, he was probably looking out the window every day. "I wonder where my son is. I wonder what, you know, there's a hole in his heart. I wonder whatever happened to that youngest son of mine." He looks out the window longingly, and one day, while he was still far off, he He catches a glimpse. So he leaves his home, goes out of his way, beyond, you know, think about all the times this guy crosses the threshold of his home in this story. This is the first time he does that, to receive his son. He puts his arm around him, and the son practices the speech that he's been rehearsing all the way home. He says, "Father, I have sinned before heaven and against you, against heaven and before you, I forget which way. I am not fit to be called your son." And he doesn't even get to finish the speech. His father interrupts him and he says, "Welcome home." And then he starts giving orders, like the chief patriarch in the story would. And the, "Bring me a fatted calf, bring me a robe, bring me a ring, for my son who was dead is alive again." And as if there could be anything worse than that, he says, "My son who was lost is now found." Extravagant, extraordinary grace and welcome he extends to this son. Even though he was a mess up, a failure, a loser, as somebody might call him in our, and yet he's welcomed home, and he's embraced, and he's given a party. And so the party begins to ensue, and there's music. We picture music and food. Obviously, there's a fatted calf. So the other son catches wind of this. He says, "Hey, what's going on?" I love that little line. "What's going on? Oh, didn't you hear? Your brother, who was lost, is now home, safe and sound, and your father is happy, and he's throwing him a party because he's got his son back." What? And he stays out. He will not go in. That's all it says. He will not go in. So for a second time in this story, the father crosses the threshold of his own home to receive a son who is lost to him, basically. Right? The one son is lost because of the prodigalness, the dissolute living. This son is lost because of his anger and his jealousy. And the father goes out and embraces this son, you know, and he pleads with him. But then he gets this speech from the older son, the responsible one. "I stayed here all these years. I've always done the work. You've never even given me a little party for my friends, you know, like a goat or something so we could celebrate." And the father's, "Son, you're always with me. All that I have is yours. But your brother has been lost and now is found. He was dead, but now he lives." So what do we take from this story? Are we trying to learn how to get along with one another, how to be a brother? What's the best way to be a little brother? What's the best way to be an older brother? Those are good. Those are all right ways. We can learn from the story that way. We certainly get our buttons pushed. I saw it happen in Bible study. I see it almost every time we crack something, one of these open. But man, that older brother, he had it all together. He was the responsible one. Why doesn't he get more? You know what? We have built churches and altars and sanctuaries in homage to a God who looks like the older brother. A God who keeps score. A God who wants you to do the right thing, to be responsible, to obey the rules, to shoot up and show up, do the work. And when all that happens, someday we'll throw a party for you, a banquet. We have worshiped a God who looks like the older brother. We certainly don't worship the younger brother, you know, not in our culture. Maybe in some places they do. There is a place in Las Vegas, I guess, they build casinos and places that welcome the younger brother to come spend your money. Hey, have I got a deal for you? But the church has missed the point. If we think God is like either the younger brother or the older brother, if this is a parable to open our eyes about the nature and character of God, why are we still keeping score and tracking everything like it's attendance and what you give and all the things that the responsible one holds to be so important? The picture of the father in this story Let's play a little fill-in-the-blank game here. When he sees his son who's come home from a far apart way, he has blank for him. Or he is filled with blank. Love?
Joy?
Compassion. The actual word is compassion. Ding, ding, ding. We have a winner. Let's play fill in the blank with some other words. He saw his son who had gone off and squandered his inheritance, and he was filled with, now how do you really feel about it? How do you feel about it? Anger? Frustration? Judgment? Relief that he's back? Okay. But see, we have an angry, judging God sometimes. I don't think we do in this church, but I think we deal with it in our culture and in Christianity in general, that, yeah, when you mess up, there is literally hell to pay. But the picture that Jesus gives us, there's none of that in this story anywhere. Only through the older brother do we get a little bit of jealousy. Let's fill in the blanks with the brother. When the brother sees his brother come home, he doesn't even call him brother. Says, this son of yours, like this other family member who will heretofore be identified as brother A. He's got no name. He's not my brother. He's this other son of yours. He was filled with hate, anger, jealousy, frustration. These are not the words we use to describe God. Anger. Knowing right from wrong. You know, some of that we attribute to God, but the God we have here is completely about grace and compassion and welcome. Not just to one son, but to both sons. So let's build a church to that God. Can we do that? Can we build a church to the God of compassion? The God who says, welcome home? Because honestly, again, back to this big story, I think that's the big story that's in all of us. That's what makes this story always true, is every one of us wants to know that we are welcome home. Whether we've gone to a far-off land or whether we've stayed home this whole time, we want to know that wherever we are, God's arms are there to embrace us, to welcome us with compassion, and to just see the joy in the Father's eyes that says, you're home. Let us rejoice. Welcome home.